Just you and me this week, Sonny.
Holding Hogan it down.
Holding down. Hogan could not be with us, but I'm glad to see you here. And how was your week as we tape this coming to the end of the week? How's it been going?
It's good. It's been a very busy, busy long week, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. But all is well. My baby has 4 teeth now. And
what?
Yes. So we are, they're breaking through, which is good because that, as you know, Tim, waiting for those teeth to come in, it's a rough time. A lot of crying.
Well, I don't really remember it, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean with my children?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. It was rough for them. I don't remember going through it myself exactly, but
I thought that's
what you meant.
Yeah, been a rough few months there, but now that they're through, we're getting some sleep in.
And that's good. I heard the young fella just squawking in the background.
Yeah, I put him outside with the dog.
Good. That's a good place. Yeah, that works, you know, for a while until the dog gets annoyed.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it could be trouble. Well, thanks for joining us. I wish everybody would click subscribe and like and follow, depending on what format you're watching or listening on. And I also would like to point out that we're about 2.5 weeks into after the publication date of my new book, which is called Swing Hard, In Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and Shot at Redemption on the Trump Campaign. It's doing very well. Amazon.com. Sonny, I actually went into a Barnes & Noble in Fairfax, Virginia, and I saw it on the shelves.
I saw your tweet. Yeah, that's awesome. You want to know, I have a story about this. Can I share it?
Sure, please.
So I was at my parents' house the other day, and Eli, my little brother, picked up your book randomly, just starts flipping through it. And I was like, hold on, Eli, let me show you something. I flipped to the page and I pointed at my name, and he was like, whoa, what? Your name is in a book?
Yeah,
I was like, yes, it sure is.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad. Well, Eli has excellent taste in literature, so it's available on Amazon.com. It's partly about my life in politics, and specifically a lot about the 2020 Trump campaign. Some stories that have never been published before in there. Some of them, many of them, you lived through directly, Sonny. And the other half of the book is my decades-long battle with alcohol and trying to escape addiction, which I finally did in 2015. There are a lot of harrowing stories in here, and I think that I've been told it's an entertaining read, and I think a lot of times you might just shake your head and say, man, how did this guy survive?
I've seen a lot of tweets about it, Tim. People saying how good it is to read, how captivating and just entertaining it is, which I agree. And when I read it, thought the same thing. I highly recommend. Great book to read.
Thank you. I'm glad that my trials and tribulations are like a train wreck that you can't look away from. So
maybe there'll be a movie made out of it.
Yeah. You think? I don't know. Tom Cruise? Would Tom Cruise play me?
I think so. Yeah, that would be a good fit.
He's a little older than I am, I think, but the resemblance is there.
Well, you'd have to add in some action. We got to like add in some
fight scenes. You know what? In the book, there is one fight scene. I can see you haven't read it. There is a fight scene. It's not much of a fight scene. A friend of mine from high school and I get into a little scrape with a couple of toughs, and it does not go well for the good guys.
Oh, it's okay. Every boy needs a good fight.
Right. Yeah. All right. So anyway, let's get to it. There's lots to talk about in the world of politics and current events, because this is the Line Drive Podcast. All right. I want to start with something that happened in my hometown, Philadelphia. Sonny, did you see? You know what a Wawa is, right? Do you know what a Wawa is?
I do. I've been to a Wawa.
Let's talk about it. What do you know about Wawa, and how do you compare it to other stores like Sheetz or something like that?
Let me just say, I've only been to maybe one or two Wawas back when I lived in D.C. and was driving back and forth home. I think I stopped at one time. We have Sheetz here, though, and Sheetz is
good.
This is the premier gas station around here. I mean, it's no Buc-ee's. We don't have Buc-ee's here. No. Have you been to Buc-ee's, by the way?
I have never been to a Buc-ee's. Our mutual friend Kalen swears by Buc-ee's.
Oh, yes, he does.
And I have some high school friends who have sent me pictures like, but going to Buc-ee's is like going to Six Flags or Disney World or something. That's the way people Bucky's, talk about it.
Yeah, Bucky's tops everything. It beats Wawa. It beats Sheetz. It beats, I don't know, Exxon.
Exxon, sure. Of course it beats Exxon.
But yeah, so I don't really have much to say about the Wawa versus Sheetz. I don't typically spend a lot of time going to gas stations other than to get gas. I don't really go into them. My husband, on the other hand, loves to go into Sheetz and get those smoothie icy things that they have. Does Wawa have that?
Wawa does now. They have milkshake machines and you can get, I don't know what else you can get out of those things, but yeah. And then now they have the order, like everybody does now, the touchscreen order stuff where you can customize your sandwich. When I grew up, let me tell you why we're talking about this. So Joe Biden went to Wawa the other day because he spends a lot of time in the Philadelphia area because it's easy for him to get to. And this doesn't involve a lot of travel. The old fella can't take those long trips, you know, like some other candidates and presidents have been able to do. So he stays basically in the Amtrak Acela corridor largely, which is what he's used to. But he's in Philadelphia the other day and he went to a Wawa. And this piece of tape is better for people watching on Rumble because there's not a whole lot of audio to it. So here's what, you know how it goes with the presidential visit. You know, the advance team comes in, they make sure everything is down, and there was video of them going through practicing for the Biden visit before Biden got there. And they had it all down where he was going to tip the person who was waiting on him. They had it all, and they have video of them choreographing his visit before he got there. And then he shows up, he gets confused, the whole thing goes to hell because he ruins it, you know. So here it is after he finally showed up. And for the viewing audience rather than the listening audience, this is better. But he gets confused by a takeout box, by a Wawa takeout box. And then somebody has put the thought into his head that he's going to be able to get a milkshake while he's at Wawa. So he wanders off in pursuit of the milkshake and leaves everybody else standing back where they had rehearsed that they were going to be. So it's really great. Here it is.
Mr. President, I'm going to pick up a few pounds here.
And don't forget, we also included drinks for you as well, just to enjoy.
We can take that box.
You can take that box?
Yeah.
I'm going to go order a milkshake.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not the best piece of video. And the reason why it's not the best piece of video is because they had no television cameras stationed over there to be ready for him because they had not practiced that part. And he just went wandering over.
You know, I have not seen that actual video right there. And I just have so much sympathy when I'm watching him move around. It is just like slow motion, completely out of it, not knowing where he's going. And it's honestly like pretty sad to watch, in my opinion. But you contrast that with President Trump's trips that he's been taking, like to Chick-fil-A that he did in Georgia the other day, or to the bodega in New York, night and day, just complete night and day. I mean, you got the president. First of all, the place is packed with press, with supporters, wherever he goes. Complete opposite of Joe Biden visiting this gas station, trying to do a neat little off the record, which is so funny too. Yes, we talk about advance goes and they know, you know, what the layout is. I think more so for like a safety standpoint to know how to protect the president, but just scripting out every single moment is absolutely insane. Do you think
especially
they can do
that? He's not going to follow the script.
No, absolutely not. And it's just so sad to watch. It's not inspiring. It's not uplifting. It's not even like pandering because he can't even fit in with like, oh, I'm such a normal guy, even though that's his like shtick that he tries to use and say, oh, I'm just Joe from Scranton or Delaware or wherever he's from that day. But it really is just, it's so awkward and like sad to watch because it's not, it does, you don't even get feel good vibes watching it.
No, there's none of that. And you know, it's funny when in having watched the setup where they're rehearsing it, when you do a trip like this, the purpose of it is for the president or any candidate for a lesser office or something like that. You're supposed to sort of, you're walking into a slice of American life that is ongoing, that is currently happening, right? This is a business. It's a Wawa. This is the president dropping in on Americans going about their daily routine, whether they work there or where their customers did. Now, of course, everyone knows the president is coming and there's preparation for that and all that stuff. But the illusion is supposed to be, here's the president dropping in on people while they're doing normal stuff, right? That's the idea.
Right. Yeah.
They have this whole thing scripted. It's become like a make-believe wah-wah. And right. Biden walked in and everything is so tightly controlled. There are no regular customers in there.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, they've got the people who work there who are going to walk him step by step through the very complicated act of purchasing a milkshake.
So did right? he get it? Did he get the milkshake?
I don't know. So he go. I didn't see how the story ended. So I don't
how
know.
How will we ever know? So,
but it's like a Truman Show kind of thing where the whole thing is totally phony. But Biden walks in. He's the only one who doesn't realize that the whole thing's a setup. You know, he's like living real life and everybody else. Yeah. Is like, knows where they're supposed to be. If this were a movie, they have the scene blocked out. You know, there might, for all I know, there might be tape on the floor showing there, people.
I mean, probably. But be. You know, what's also sad is like, do you think he realizes that he is being coddled throughout the whole thing? Like the woman that's with him, that was with him during that clip, just, you know, very subtly guiding him, saying like, okay, Mr. President, like, let's go over here. And everyone, I think, is just totally on edge waiting for him to say something that he's going to mess up or that they're going to have to clean up. But I mean, we've already been over this, but it's just so sad. It's not inspiring. And I think the more of these things that he does shows just how out of touch he is with regular everyday people. And I think it's going to continue to make him just plummet in the polls even more so than he is.
Yeah, I think so. The more this is what he was protected from in 2020.
Right.
Go out because of COVID. It's exactly stuff like this. Yeah. You can tell it's not just this one, but in other scenes, you can tell everyone around him, you know, the people who work there at Wawa, and whoever that woman was standing next to him, you know, they're terrified. You can tell that everyone is just on edge and they're all extremely nervous about what he's going to do, you know? And I think he looks at her, for all I know, I bet you he thought she was his nurse. You know, who's this nurse? You know,
I don't know about that, but just
oh, here's taking this nice lady helping me.
Yeah, taking it back to like politically how this affects him. He doesn't have a record to run on right now. And when he does these things to try to connect with voters, in my opinion, copying President Trump, because he saw how successful President Trump's trip to Chick-fil-A was the other day. That was a huge success. And, you know, with super viral moments and clips and things like that, the Biden campaign says, oh, let's take a page out of that book, try to mimic it and kind of generate our own press.
Right. And so because the thing was Trump bought milkshakes for everybody at the Chick-fil-A. Right. And so if the Biden people said, ha ha, watch this, we'll send Biden in and he's going to get a milkshake, too. Well, that was a disaster. Because that was the result. We just saw what the result. So I don't have tape of Trump at the Chick-fil-A with getting his buying 31 milkshakes or whatever.
The Lord's chicken.
For the customers. Yeah. It is the Lord's chicken. I love me some Chick-fil-A. We go there twice a week, probably. But he did go to on the opening day of his trial or jury selection on Monday of this week. He did pop by a bodega, which you just mentioned. And it's a bodega where the owner, by the New York City DA, was thrown into Rikers Island and charged with serious felonies. I don't know exactly the charge, but a felony charge because he defended himself inside the bodega and fought off a would-be robber. And now he is being charged by the same out-of-control DA. So let me play. And here's Trump. Mind you, this is Manhattan. This is New York City, which is, I don't know what, somewhere between 80 and 90% Democrat every time they vote in a federal election. And here's Trump's response when he gets out of the car and he's on the sidewalk there outside the bodega. So it's a little bit different, little bit different. Now, let me tell you why I think this is important. And I know, you know, the campaign is going to make noise about, hey, maybe New York is in play. And so, and that's fine. They can say that. I mean, New York is a tough nut to crack, right, for Republicans. But why that is important is to me, you have a large crowd outside of bodega and you have a large crowd gathered on the sidewalk, all of them screaming and yelling four more years and all that. They love Trump. That is a largely Latino audience of people outside this bodega. We already know that there's a poll after poll after poll that shows that Trump is doing far better among Latino voters than any Republican has ever done in a presidential race. And in fact, in some polls, he's actually winning Latino voters, beating Joe Biden among Latino voters. There, if people are paying attention, this is what we call in campaigns sort of a permission moment. You run TV ads of this nature sometimes, but if there is someone, whether it's a Latino voter or another voter of color, somewhere a Black voter or an Asian voter, somewhere around the country, and they're told by their friends or by the media, you're not supposed to like this guy. You're not supposed to like Donald Trump because of the color of your skin, because other people with the same skin color don't like him. Therefore, you shouldn't like him too. That's a message that a lot of minority voters get from the media and from leftists within their minority group. They see this and they see Latinos reacting so positively to Donald Trump. That gives them permission in their own lives, in their own communities, to say, you know what? Those people who look like me, they support the guy. It's okay if I support him too. It's permission. And so it's not necessarily the people who are gathered there on the sidewalk, the primary audience, that is the main audience that's of benefit. It's the larger audience that saw that tape either on TV or more likely on social media. It gives them permission to also support the guy. That's why I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, also too, going back to the Chick-fil-A visit, Michaela Montgomery, she's the one that hugged President Trump and had that viral picture that went absolutely crazy. She's been doing a lot of media since that. And that's something that she's been talking about, is the support that since she had her moment in the spotlight, that she's had so many people come to her on Instagram or Facebook or whatever and just say, you know what, hey, I support him too. And maybe I haven't supported him in the past, but now I see how bad Joe Biden has done for my community and just the country in general. And now I think that I'm going to be supporting President Trump because he's got such a great record to run on. And he's done way more for us than Joe Biden and the Democrats claim that they could do for us. But like you say, talking about New York, that was a great, I mean, seeing both sides of the street lined with supporters for President Trump. In New York, Manhattan, of all places. I mean, that's a great sign. That I think that's a really like telltale sign of how many people are just fed up with, one, how they're treating him, and two, their own lives. They see what this justice system is doing to the president. And I think a lot of just regular people are realizing that this is not fair. This isn't American, and something needs to be done about it.
Yeah, let's talk about not just this trial, but all of the trials. But this is the one that's front and center now. I think, and I've talked about this before, but the first question that anybody should ask themselves about all of these different things is, would any of it be happening if he were not running for president again? And the answer, obviously, I think, is no. Of course, none of these things would be happening. He wouldn't be charged with any of these made up crimes if he were not running for president again. And once you arrive at that, I think even hardcore Democrats must admit that it's not normal to have gone after the guy. And if he weren't running for president, it wouldn't be happening. And that means that the whole thing is political. It's entirely political from beginning to end. And I mean, you see what's happening there. What they've tried to put on is a show trial in the middle of the media capital of the world. And I think that as one at a time when the indictments were all announced in the four different jurisdictions, that was all during the Republican primary, and it made Trump stronger every time that it happened. Now, the idea, Trump has been saying it for a long time, and his supporters have been saying it for a long time. We've been talking about it for a long time, that he's being prosecuted because he's running for president. He always says, they're coming after me because they're trying to get to you, meaning his supporters. And that was all, until this point, it was all very theoretical. You know, it was telling people, you know, they're coming after me. And so people could hear that and understand it. And they read the news and they know the indictments have happened and all that stuff. But now he's actually in court every day. And no cameras are allowed in the courtroom. And so what's happened is they've gone, and the media has gone and hired the old-fashioned court artist, the court sketch artist, which does, you know, pastel and chalk or whatever medium they're using, drawings of what's going inside the courtroom. And now what was once theoretical, the idea of Trump being hauled into court, they're actually seeing it with these court drawings, which actually make it more dramatic because they're the old fashioned court drawings. It's I think it's much more impactful than videotape from inside the courtroom would be. Mm-hmm. And they've actually put a visual to what was previously theoretical. And they're actually showing people that the Democrats are trying to put the man in jail.
And yeah,
I think the indictments and the theoretical thought of a criminal trial helped Trump. But now that they've put pictures to it, I think it makes it even stronger for Trump. And I think there's got to be some national Democrats, people in the Biden camp that have been for a long time thinking that they've made a mistake maybe in overreaching and going after Trump with all these things. And I got to believe they're looking at this thing and, man, this is even worse than before. The guy's going to be rebound to his advantage, don't you think? Even more.
Well, you would think that they would have learned that at some point, because when all of these indictments started coming out a few months ago, like it's been a while now that all of this has started up, he shot up in the polls. And it was the complete opposite reaction as to what they were expecting. They were hoping that this would just tear him down to the point where public opinion of him was so bad that if they could just pile on indictment after indictment, then public opinion would sway so far, there's no chance that he would win this November. But the complete opposite has happened. The more they pile on, the more his popularity goes up. And they can continue to try to weaponize this justice system against him. But the fact remains that he did nothing wrong. And they have placed him in just a completely unfair situation here with just the worst judge that they could possibly give him, a jury pool of people from Manhattan, like you said earlier, 80-90% voted Democrat in the last 2020-2016 election. They're not giving him a fair trial at all. And I do think that regular people are seeing that and they're saying, you know what, this is not fair. I don't like this. This is un-American. And I think I might be switching my support to President Trump.
Yeah. I mean, at best, this is a campaign finance issue that somehow the DA has elevated to, you know, felonies. Most times, even if it were true, it's basically a minor fine to the Federal Election Commission. And that is at the worst case scenario. That's what's at issue here. But somehow the DA in New York has elevated this to a felony and the guy is facing 4 years in jail over this.
But I don't know.
Basically, is a discrepancy of campaign finance paperwork. Basically,
it's completely insane, and they're using this to keep him off the trail, the campaign trail.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and an unconstitutional. They're not letting him talk about an unconstitutional gag order. They have the DA who campaigned for office on getting Trump, elect me, and I'm much like Fannie Willis down in Georgia, getting Trump. The judge personally contributed to Joe Biden's campaign in 2020. The whole case rests on the testimony of Michael Cohen, who is a known perjurer, and also Stormy Daniels, who herself signed an affidavit in 2018 stating that none of the underlying issues ever even happened. And so, I mean, it's just an absurd case. And of course, I do think it's serious. And, you know, he has to deal with it and his lawyers are handling it. Jury selection, you know, they took that seriously because it is a criminal charge and it exists no matter how dumb it is, obviously dumb it is on its face. He still has to treat it like it's a serious issue because it is for him personally. It's serious. But the whole thing is bogus.
Yeah, absolutely. Just completely insane that this is even happening. But going back to the bodega visit, I was thinking, imagine when I was watching him, he seemed so energized being there with all those supporters around him. And I think that had to be a very encouraging moment for him in the middle of all of this crazy trial stuff that's going on, how they're attacking him and his business and his family. I think that moment being in Manhattan, pretty much the worst place he could be in terms of popularity, and to have that many people come up and support him and show that they are standing with him, I think that was a very encouraging moment for him. At least it looked like that from his facial expressions, his body language, everything seemed to be a really happy time.
Yeah, I think he was energized by that. And, you know, faced with the drudgery of sitting in the courtroom
for
hour upon hour upon hour. I mean, and keeping him off the campaign trail. But, you know, I do think this is going to make him stronger. It helps his candidacy. Previously, like I said, the indictments that would that was happening during the Republican primary. This is happening during the general election. And I think that the Democrats thought that once they got into the general election, that it would be safe for them to continue attacking him because I think they thought that people would rally to their side. But I'm telling you, based in this is all politics is nothing but a series of microcosmic anecdotes. You know, that scene outside the bodega, the scene inside the Chick-fil-A, those KFC. Are different. I'm sorry, not big mistake. I almost
Sorry.
Chick-fil-A, not to be confused with KFC or Popeyes or anything else. No. Those are two different areas of the country, different demographics about as far as who lives in the immediate area. And you saw the reaction was the same there. And those two things in themselves don't win elections, but they are an indicator. And as I said, and as you pointed out, as you know, that the lady from the Chick-fil-A has been on TV, and it's a permission thing. The more that happens, people around the country will say, you know what? Let me take a second look at this guy. It's like nobody, there's nobody out there who doesn't already have an opinion of Donald Trump in some way. But it's a matter of, I do think that. However, he also has the benefit of now voters are comparing the Biden presidency and the Trump presidency side by side. And it's no contest. Yeah. The Trump presidency wins.
Yeah. Easily. On the merits, yes, absolutely. I mean, he wins every time. Have you seen those videos? I think this happened more so in 2020 during the campaign. People would do man on the street videos and they would just give the policy and not attach it to a name. And and I also saw them do it with the racist things that Joe Biden has said throughout his career. And everyone was shocked when they attached a name to the person or to the quote, I should say. And yeah, on the merits and in on the record, he wins every time. His policies win every single time.
Yeah, and it's a long fight, and the election day is like almost 7 months from now, and anything can happen. But man, oh man, if the election were today, I think he would win.
Oh yeah.
So I spent a lot of time. I'm gonna get to this thing before we wrap up for this week, Sonny. If you have a few more minutes,
of course.
I spent a lot of time on this show, and when I do media hits and I write a column about it every 2 weeks in the Washington Times, complaining about the leftist media and how they're incredibly biased. And one of the great pastimes for conservatives has always been bashing National Public Radio, right? You know, especially because it's funded by taxpayer money. Well, there was this giant upheaval earlier this week. at NPR, and they've been getting a ton of attention in just the last few days because there's a guy named Yuri Berliner. I think that's how you say his name. Like the German city Berliner, like someone who lives in there, Yuri Berliner, like someone from Berlin who had worked at, and I say had because it is now past tense, but when he wrote and published this essay in a publication called The Free Press, thefreepress.com, I think it is. Earlier this week, he's a 25-year veteran of NPR who was, until earlier this week, a senior business editor at NPR. And he published this essay in The Free Press, just absolutely excoriating NPR for its leftist viewpoints. Did you see any of this?
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, I did. I saw some coverage of it. I haven't heard anything that he personally had to say, but I have seen coverage of this. Yeah.
So I wrote my column about this week. And so here's what he found. So he watched what happened inside NPR's headquarters in Washington from the point where Donald Trump came onto the political scene 2015 and how NPR began to handle stories, political stories, in the months and years that followed. And so when he did this, he decided to look at the voter registration, publicly available information, voter registration data for people who held senior positions inside NPR. And he found that he looked at 87 different people, 87, first of all, 87 different editors inside NPR's headquarters. That sounds like a lot of editors. That's amazing. Yeah, anyway, all 87 of them, 100%, were registered Democrats. He found out of the editors in the NPR headquarters, he found exactly zero Republican registered voters.
This was in 2015 or this is currently?
No, this is currently.
Currently, okay.
So, because he just wrote this essay this past week. And then he went through a bunch of stories that NPR missed because they had obvious political overtones and they sided with the anti-Trump angle every time, and they were wrong. He was talking about the Russia hoax, and they had Adam Schiff on the air on NPR. You want to, how many times do you think Adam Schiff was on NPR talking about the Russia hoax?
Too many to count.
25.
Oh, my gosh.
25 times. So obviously that was wrong. They got the Hunter Biden laptop story wrong. They're one, a senior person at NPR, the famous response to that at the time was, quote, "We don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories." That's what NPR said, saying that it wasn't true. Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, the laptop was real. NPR didn't care. Their COVID-19 coverage, they decided that you weren't allowed to say that that originated from a lab leak in Wuhan, China. That was racist. And a conspiracy theory, right? So they got it all wrong, and then they never even acknowledged that they were wrong. That was when it really started to bother him. Like, we got all these stories wrong because of our innate political bias, and when we move on, we don't say anything about it.
Yeah.
And he goes on and on and on about how they all they care about is the diversity of the newsroom and not diversity of viewpoints and all that stuff. And so I wrote a column about it because I thought it was so remarkable that this guy would write this, blasting NPR while he worked there.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't believe he's writing this while he works at this place. Well, guess what? He doesn't anymore because it didn't take long. He got suspended almost immediately. And then he resigned during the course of the week.
The problem is that, one, NPR is government funded, and two, that they portray themselves as like this overarching entity of truth that, you know, they are the place to go to for news, non-bias. If you just want the facts, you know, come to NPR or listen to NPR or whatever. And it is complete opposite. I mean, like you said, they clearly don't even have any Republicans like in leadership there. And when you don't even have that little diversity of truth, not even never Trumpers, they don't have a single registered Republican in leadership. That, I mean, no, can you not even just get like one person just to say you have somebody, even if they, you know, are a never Trumper or whatever? Unreal. And shout out to this guy for having the backbone to do this. It's going to take people like him to, if we ever want to have any kind of truth back into journalism. It's going to take whistleblowers and people standing up and saying, you know, this is wrong. We're not being fair in our coverage.
Yeah. This guy should be considered a whistleblower. He absolutely should. And so the one of the things that he said was, people have heard about this essay, I think, and they probably saw some reference to it on Twitter, but I think it's really important to note some of the things, some of the specific things that he said that was going on inside of NPR. For example, they were required to participate. They had a tracking system inside NPR where they kept track of the racial and gender demographics of the people that they interviewed for their stories, for the NPR stories. They actually keep track, and there's a database of sorts inside NPR of the skin color of the people that they put in their news stories. So they can keep track and make sure that they're balancing it out. That's insane.
So that they want to make sure that they're well represented on, but they don't want to take into account the viewpoints and beliefs of at least 50% of the country.
Right.
All they care about is skin
diversity
color.
Diversity of gender and skin color and no doubt sexual orientation.
Yeah.
But nothing about ideological point of view. There is you can discriminate against viewpoint all day long. In fact, they will cheer. But then the editor-in-chief, a woman named Edith Chapin, she wrote a response that was circulated internally. And of course, it leaked out in about 5 seconds. Yeah. And in there, she said, some of these things are just howlingly funny. She said, quote, "Rigorous debate and self-examination are necessary parts of our pursuit of the facts." No, it's not. First of all, you cannot have rigorous debate when you have zero people who disagree.
When you all believe the same thing.
Who is going to be debating when everyone believes the same? So that's a joke. And second, self-examination. I'm sorry. The fella who just published an essay that pointed out all the things that you're doing that are incredibly biased, he got suspended and then basically felt like he had no choice to resign. So where's the self-examination? This guy raises his hand and say, "Hey, we're doing all this stuff wrong," and he's out of a job. So how much self-examination and rigorous debate is there? Okay, she goes on, quote, "We believe that inclusion among our staff, with our sourcing, and in our overall coverage is critical to telling the nuanced stories of this country and our world." But there's no inclusion at all because there are no Republicans at all. This is insane. It's insane. It's in the face of facts that are directly contrary to what she's saying.
Is this guy a Democrat himself?
Yes. The guy who wrote the piece. Yeah. He describes himself at the beginning. Let me see here. He describes himself as, I got it here somewhere, a liberally educated Subaru driver who voted against Trump twice and was raised by a mother who is a lesbian peace activist.
Okay.
That's how he describes himself. So he is not, he is not a Reagan conservative. He's not a Trump Republican. He's not MAGA. He's not, he's not even close.
Should I start describing myself as a Chrysler Pacifica driver now that I have a van?
Oh, geez. You drive a
van. I know.
Pretty soon you'll be a soccer mom.
I'm not really a fan of soccer, so I'm kind of hoping that he plays like football or baseball or something, some real sport, you know?
Yeah. I got to wrap this up with this crazy stuff that Ms. Chapin said. And then I want to get to what the new CEO said, if we have time for that. So she continues on. She says, "It's why we track sources so we can expand the diversity of perspectives in our reporting." That's her sticking up for them, the way that they keep track of the skin pigmentation of the people that they interview for their stories. "So we can expand the diversity of perspectives in our reporting," she says. That's important, to have a different point of view in your stories, except, of course, in the people who are writing the stories. You can't have diversity of perspectives among the people who are writing the stories. It's insane. And then she finishes up, and then you can tee off. "Let's not forget that the reason we remain one of the most trusted news organizations in the country is that we respect people's ability to form their own judgments." Two things. You can't be letting people form their own judgments when you are holding back half of the story all the time.
Right.
No one can form an accurate judgment when you're telling them lies and half truths and half of stories. And the other thing, calling themselves the most trusted label, giving themselves the most trusted label, what they're talking about, and this is something that Yuri Berliner pointed out, what they're talking about is a recent Harris poll that teams up with Harvard a lot that showed that 3 out of 10 NPR listeners considered NPR to be, quote, trustworthy. 3 out of 10. Now, granted, that's higher than CNN scored or higher than the New York Times scored. So sure. But who's bragging? Not even Joe Biden brags about a 30% approval rating. But NPR is saying, yeah, look at us. We're trustworthy. No, 30% is the bottom line.
The only thing I was going to add to that is, if they want to keep track of, you know, the diversity of who they're interviewing and all that, that's great. That's wonderful. Everyone deserves to have their voices heard. Every group, minority, all of that. Wonderful. Great. But when
keeping
you're
track
not,
of it is a little bit weird.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. But when you're not going to include differing political ideologies, then that really does not matter. If you're only keeping track of certain things and you're only allowing certain voices in and not other voices, then all you are is an echo chamber for people who agree with you. So, I mean, congrats on your 3 out of 10 people that like you, but the rest of America don't.
I mean, if they were baseball players, a 300 average will get you in the Hall of Fame.
That's true.
For a news organization, 30% is not too good. It's
not
a different
so good.
Standard. Not so good.
Yeah.
So anyway, that brings us to their new CEO. Is a woman named Catherine, and I presume it's spelled exactly the same way as Bill Maher's last name. Mm. So I presume it's pronounced the same. So let's say Catherine Maher, M-A-H-E-R, Catherine Maher. She is now the CEO of NPR. A bunch of Republican, right, conservative activists have unearthed some of her old tweets. And she, of course, has been found out to be reliably liberal on all of her points of view. And in fact, a little bit kooky, a little on the kooky liberal scale. And she used to work for Wikipedia. which, as we know, is not, she was an executive at Wikipedia, which, as we know, is not trustworthy as far as the facts and the liberal bias in the way that the definitions of things are recorded on Wikipedia pages. And so I have two cuts here from her. I think these are interviews that were conducted while she was working for Wikipedia, but I'm not certain of that.
Okay.
Which was prior to being a CEO of NPR. So here she is. And it's curious that she would have this opinion of the First Amendment, as she is now the CEO of what she considers to be one of the most trusted news sources in the country, NPR. Here's what she has to say about the First Amendment.
The number one challenge here that we see is, of course, the First Amendment in the United States is a fairly robust protection of rights. And that is a protection of rights, both for platforms, which I actually think is very important that platforms have those rights to be able to regulate what kind of content they want on their sites. But it also means that it is a little bit tricky to really address some of the real challenges of where does bad information come from and sort of the influence peddlers who have made a real market economy around it.
Okay, so that the problems with the transmission and the electronic garbling there, that was in the original recording, not ours. There she is saying that the First Amendment she views as a pretty big obstacle because it makes it hard for you to weed out things that you don't like. And she is running a journalistic outfit now. What do you think of that?
When I say
the look on your face is like, what?
For those who are just listening, when I say my jaw dropped, that is a bold statement to say. That the First Amendment really poses a problem for them. I'd love for them to go try that in any other country. They should be thanking the Lord that they have the First Amendment freedom, but they don't. And it is just so sad that this is a state in our country where you actually have people in positions of power talking about how bad the First Amendment is. Yep. Talk about an attack on our foundations as to what makes us a country, what makes us the most free country in the entire world. And you have people like that who are attacking us. It is absolutely mind-blowing how they gain following, how they gain these high positions of power. It's dangerous. It is dangerous for the future of our country.
And, you know, that goes right in line with what we know about what NPR has done in the past, which they blocked refused to report on Hunter's laptop. And now here you have the new CEO in a past interview talking about how the First Amendment is a real obstacle to being able to
First Amendment.
How are we going to be able to prevent people from saying things? I don't know. So, but here you go. Here again, here she talked about NPR, the editor in chief, Edith Chapin, who I was just talking about. She's talking about how it's very important to get all the track the race of all the people who appear in their stories because we want to get their perspectives, even though we have zero Republicans. Here's Catherine Marr before talking about, let's talk about the word truth for a second, just that word, Sonny.
Okay.
Are there competing definitions for what truth means? What it is for something to actually be true?
In our society, yes. In real world, no, there is one truth. There is one truth. There is one set of facts. There is what is actually happened, what is accurate. And then there's the spin that everyone puts on it.
Right. Okay. So here you have now Catherine Marr, who is the chief executive officer of National Public Radio. Here she is again talking about the concept of truth.
Is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often for many people what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us.
Okay. She's the CEO of NPR talking about how what is true is a mixture of facts and basically what your opinion is. No, that's what an opinion, that's a, she's defining opinion. When you combine facts with your own personal experience and how you interpret those facts, that's opinion.
Yep.
That's not truth, no matter how you slice it.
I honestly have so much to say about this, because to me, this is a much bigger problem than just politics or, you know, what, however they're going, whatever she's talking about, this version of truth. And people say so much, live your truth. That's my truth. That's, you know, whatever. That is a detrimental idea and thought process to our society, because you start going into the realm of, well, that's my truth when it comes to moral things. Well, you know what? You know what? I feel like a cat today. That's my truth. I'm going to live my truth. No, right. You're and not. You know,
the implication is, the implication is that once you say this is my truth, that no one is allowed to question it, because you have declared this is my truth. It's impenetrable. I'm like, no, this is my truth. It's mine, and I can't be shaken off it. And you are not entitled to question it.
Yep. Right? It's very, very dangerous. And I don't like when people... Go ahead.
This would be at home in the faculty lounge at Dartmouth or someplace, mm-hmm. where they talk about how truth is malleable and they have to be mm-hmm. concerned about subjective. Everybody's point of view. So yeah, everything. No, it's you run one of the biggest newsrooms in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Truth is what it is. Facts are what they are. There is no my truth and your truth. Things are or they are not. It's unbelievable.
I have to add this in before we wrap up. I think that we have gotten to this point in our society where my truth is so popular because, as a society, we have run so far away from the one true truth, which is God, that now we're in this position where everyone has their own truth and their feelings are what is more important than what is actually factual and what is real life and what is true in the truth sense of the term. And I think it's because we've run so far away from God that when you can question where we came from, what our purpose here on this earth is, then you can question everything. Then you know, nothing is actually bad because there is no true set of truths and good and all of that. And I think that's how we've gotten here in this position. Yeah, my own personal two cents.
I think you're probably right. And you know what else? It's also a way to escape personal responsibility.
Yes.
You know, hey, man, you can't hold that against me. It's just my truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're not responsible for anything else that might actually be true, because that's just not how you see it. And that just means, I mean, could you ever find anyone guilty in a court of law? Can't Donald Trump go in there and claim my truth as his defense?
That's what I'm saying. It's such a slippery slope. This can be applied to everything.
You got to be able to get away from with everything in court, even if you mm-hmm. tell, I'm sorry, so I'm pleading my truth.
Yep.
How do you plead? My truth, Your Honor. Well, there you go. No reason to proceed. You're free to go. There you go.
Yep.
All right. Good one, Sonny.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today. Once again, please like and subscribe and do all the things. And please buy Swing Hard in case you hit it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, wherever else they sell fine books. And I would appreciate it. Sonny, good to see you. And thanks.
Thank you.
Hogan will be with us next week, I'm sure. Because this has been the Line Drive Podcast.